On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mike Huckabee is proud to say he's not the man he used to be. The former Republican governor of Arkansas went on a very public diet, dropping more than 100 pounds. Now he runs marathons and he's running for president. So far, it's been an uphill fight. Other candidates have more money and name recognition. Huckabee is hoping his conservative views on abortion, gay marriage, and evolution will sway key conservative voters. They already like his sense of humor.
I'm Mike Huckabee. For 10.5 years, I was governor of Arkansas. I'm from the small town of Hope. You may have heard of it. All I ask is, give us one more chance.
Joining me now from New York is Republican presidential contender Mike Huckabee. Earlier this year, he ended a 10.5-year run as governor of Arkansas. In 2005, Time magazine named him one of America's top five governors. He served as Arkansas attorney general and state senator. He's also an ordained Baptist minister. Welcome, Mike Huckabee.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you. Let's go straight into what looks like the news of the day. You've got Republican senators who appear to be backing away from President Bush's war plan. You've got Secretary of Defense Gates canceling his trip to Latin America and come back and hash out some emergency sort of redo or redirection. You've been very solid with President Bush on the war. Are you now recharting your course on Iraq, Mike Huckabee?
Well, I think our finger's in the dike. I don't know how much longer it can hold. The American people clearly want us to either get this resolved or get out. But the real problem, and I don't know that the president has done a very effective job of communicating it, is that if we pull away from Iraq and we just leave, there's going to be an absolute genocide going on. Then you'll see millions of people fleeing for the borders of the countries that are contiguous to Iraq. They're going to be destabilized because none of them have the infrastructure to handle that. You're going to have not a problem in Iraq. You're going to have a problem in the entire region. And it's clear that we are not just fighting with a sense of insurgency, but the terrorists have, and al-Qaeda, have made a beachhead of Iraq. They decided that they want to do there what the Taliban did in Afghanistan against the Soviets. We think in the West that the reason that the Soviet Union fell was because of the arms buildup. They couldn't keep up with it. But the Taliban believes that the reason that the Soviet Union fell had nothing to do with the United States or the West. It had simply to do with they were able to wear down the will to fight of the Soviets, and it ultimately brought about the collapse. They expect the same thing to happen in Iraq, and that's one of the issues we cannot ignore.
Governor, I've heard you say exactly that in GOP debates with all 10 guys up on the stage there. And yet, I wonder if your thinking is changing. I mean, do Senators Pete Domenici and Richard Lugard no slouch when it comes to foreign policy? Do they not believe in that scenario that you've just painted? Because they're saying now, let's get out of there. Or do they have an alternate plan? I mean, if they're changing their minds, what about you?
I don't know if what they're saying is because they truly believe that from a tactical standpoint, our best way to fight terrorism in the United States is to give terrorists an opportunity to have established a beachhead, to give them that bolster of confidence that they're looking for to show that they can wear us down. I don't know if that's a sincere position on their part. I just simply don't know that. But here's what I know. This is not a typical war. I think we have to acknowledge we made huge mistakes in Iraq, huge mistakes. Mm. When we didn't allow anyone from the Ba'ath Party to be a part of the new government, we really lost all of the people who could run that country, who could make the electric grid work or run the refineries.
But that's done. It's gone.
It's done. What I'm saying. We've got some serious problems that we can't go back and fix. But there's an old saying that it costs more to do it over than it does to do it right. I'm not sure that pulling out and then having to go back and deal with a worse issue in the Middle East, which we might be forced to do, is the right answer. Now, one of the things I'd point out, our military has not failed. They have performed with really, in many ways, less than adequate troop levels to do what they were asked to do. If there's been a failure and a breakdown, it's the Iraqi government. They have not stepped up to the level they should have. And one other failure point has been that many of the people in that region, and I think the nations like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, Turkey, these nations, it's their neighborhood. And they've not done nearly enough, militarily, diplomatically, financially, to try to bring some peace to a region that, if in fact Iraq falls and catches fire, they're going to get burned and scorched long before we will.
Yeah, people can see that, and of course, it's easy to say, doesn't make it less serious, but then, you know, we were the ones who launched the invasion. We were the ones who went in. Some people say it's unseemly to point the finger at the Iraqis now. But here's the question. If you don't agree with Senator Lugar, who says it's time to look at getting out of there, maybe as early as next spring, if you were elected president, you're running number four in Iowa now. We'll talk about that. But if you were, do you think you'd have U.S. troops in there for, and let's say you were reelected, would it be 8 more years after George Bush of Iraq war under Mike Huckabee?
I would try to realize that there's a third strategy. Our only options are not necessarily shock and awe or cut and run. There's a third one, and that's snatch and grab. You know, there have been times in our past when we have been poised to come in and do special operations to take out specific terrorists. I personally believe
you're talking about the thing that came out over the weekend in,
exactly,
in Pakistan.
What was in the New York Times.
We backed off of a raid on Al Qaeda leaders. Donald Rumsfeld
exactly
said,
right.
"No, it's too heavy in presence of U.S. troops if we go in there with 100 plus on Pakistani soil."
Well, and what doesn't make sense? What will Pakistan do? They've cashed checks for $10 billion since 9/11. I don't think they're going to suddenly not endorse those checks from us. I mean, it's absurd that we were that sensitive about the relationships with Pakistan when we had an opportunity to take out a serious al-Qaeda leader. But the snatch and grab is something I think the American people would be far more tolerant of than they would a long-standing, protracted engagement and occupation.
But that's what Iraq is, and you're saying we've got to stay.
Well, we're already there. If we had it to do over, I'm not sure that would have been our best strategy. But we can't just walk away and let it collapse. Our credibility goes. We've dishonored our military. It'll take generations to ever restore the damage we will do to them by just leaving them hanging there. And we may end up with a bigger mess than we came in to try to fix in the first place. So let's let General Petraeus have an opportunity to do what the Senate unanimously sent him there to do. What I don't understand is the very senators who said, let's give him a chance to go do it, now are backing away from their own vote.
Well, maybe they're watching closely and seeing it's not working. Let me step back. Let us step back for just a moment, if I could. On the entire war, you're very critical of the way it was handled. Many people are critical of the line that got us in there in the first place. You say it might take generations if it gets worse to repair. Many people saying it's going to take years, decades already to repair the damage done to the U.S. military, to our reputation. When you look at the American voting public, given that this was a Republican administration that took us into what's being widely described as a debacle, why should they put another Republican, you, for example, in the White House?
I think it's wrong to say it was a Republican war because, as I recall, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, just about every Democrat took to the well of the Senate and said, we've got to go in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction there.
But you know who drove the boat, who whipped the pony here. I mean, come on. You know where the great impetus for this war was. That's not a mystery.
It may not be a mystery, but it doesn't relieve Democrats to have equal responsibility for the support of this war when it started. And again, you said a moment ago, we can't go back. Well, okay, we can't go back. So the Democrats can't go back and rescind what they said and what they believed and what they did. This is not a Democrat or Republican war. It's a war in which America is engaged. We have to make sure that we get out of it as quickly as we can, but that we get out of it with honor and with victory as well as with dispatch. And that's what I think we have to recognize, that it is unlike the typical geopolitical war. It is not a geopolitical war. This is a theological war. We're fighting an enemy, not so much in Iraq. We're fighting an enemy across the world who doesn't separate church and state. They truly believe that their purpose of life is to establish a religious kingdom on this earth, and in order to do that, they have to destroy and annihilate every single living being on this planet who does not share.
Are we wise to
position.
Engage on those terms? A theological war, you say. Does that mean you think this is a crusade?
On their part? Is it a crusade on their part? It's not on our part. Our whole strategy is that we're perfectly willing to let them live where they live. But they are not going to leave us alone if we leave them alone. And that's a very naive position. When I hear people say that, it's obvious they've never really read the documents of the radical Islamists who are leading this war, they are not the kind of people who are going to say, you know what, if you just stay in your part of the world, we'll stay in ours and we'll have a wonderful, peaceful coexistence. That's total naivete.
We've got a minute before the break. Is it making it harder for you, Governor, when Republicans are shifting position on the war, when you're in the middle of fighting with the position you've just outlined? Does it make it harder when Richard Lugar says, wait, let's point our guns and toward home, maybe?
I wouldn't say it makes it harder. It makes it more interesting, perhaps. And it just shows that this is not something that is simple, easy, pretty, and it doesn't have any quick or painless or maybe perfect solutions. But I think we also have to understand that in life there are many issues we face that don't have perfect solutions. And so we're going to have to make the best decisions we can based on what we're dealing with. You know, Donald Rumsfeld made a statement. He said, we don't go to war with the army that we want. We go to war with the army that we have. In essence, that sums up what was wrong from the beginning, and that is the real perspective ought to be, we don't go to war with the army we want, and we don't go to war with the army we have. We ought to go to war with the army that we need, and that's not what we did.
Mike Huckabee, I wish you'd give us your snapshot right now of where you think this GOP race for the nomination stands. How do you describe this moment in the long arc of this 08 campaign in your party?
Well, Zahn, the key is the long arc. It's more a marathon than a sprint. I've said from the beginning that if people looked at this as whoever was in front at the beginning, that was how things were going to turn out, they'd probably be miserably wrong. And not just because this is an exceptionally long process. That's historically true. Back in 1980, Ronald Reagan was running third. Nobody thought he would be the nominee. John Connally had all the money, looked like he was the inevitable. Second place looked like George Herbert Walker Bush. Ronald Reagan was a distant third. A lot of the establishment was still mad at him for running against Gerald Ford in 1976. He became the nominee. He won the presidency twice. We've seen other inevitables. Phil Graham was the inevitable nominee because he had so much money, and he went into it just overwhelmed with ready cash, as he liked to call it. It's not uncommon for us to, at this point of the race, have somebody that just seems like they're unstoppable, but they don't ever get there. Howard Dean was the unstoppable force even 8 years ago or 4 years ago. So
John McCain, you know, looked big, and now he's stumbling a little bit. But here's my question: the front three in the GOP have all drawn criticism from GOP conservatives, saying they're not conservative enough, or they've come too recently to their conservative positions. We've got to find somebody else. And a lot of people are looking at Fred Thompson now. Why is that? He's out in Hollywood. You're already in the race. Why are they looking at Fred when you're right there, Mike Huckabee?
Well, I think they don't know me as well as they know Fred, and they know Fred because they see him on television. I mean, let's face it. Right now, the whole presidential process is more about celebrity and money than it is ideas. I mean, I'm out there talking about a complete overhaul of the tax system. No other candidate is really pushing that. It would completely end our current process of taxing productivity. We would exchange it with a consumption tax instead.
Out with the income tax and in with a kind of value-added tax. You'd pay on everything
you
bought.
But it wouldn't be a VAT. No, it's actually called the Fair Tax, developed by a group of economists from Harvard, MIT, Stanford. Arthur Laffer was one of the economists who developed the concept of the Fair Tax. But you wouldn't have income tax on individuals or corporations. You wouldn't have tax on savings or dividends or capital gains. In essence, you don't penalize productivity. What you do is you eliminate all of the tax on what you earn and how you earn it. You put the tax on the consumption side. And what has happened in this country, we've lost $10 trillion of capital that's moved offshore because companies park it somewhere else to keep it from getting raided by the Internal Revenue Service. The $10 billion a year Internal Revenue Service would disappear. We wouldn't have it anymore because we wouldn't need to have income tax. You'd get your entire paycheck every month. And one of the things that I like best about the Fair Tax is that it actually empowers people at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. The people who are living where I grew up, down there at the working class, barely being able to pay the rent. Because every month, Tom, there's a prebate that figures in so that the consumption tax applied to the rate of poverty for each member of a household And that's a cash check that comes to each American citizen.
So you pay on consumption, but if you're down at the poverty level, you'd get a rebate on what you've spent and paid on that tax.
You'd actually get it anyway, no matter where you are on the economic spectrum. But it's especially helpful if you are at the poverty level, because it's going to eliminate, in a sense, any taxes you would be paying on food or medicine or basic necessities of life. So there's a really special empowering to the people at the lowest level of the economic spectrum. So
that's a huge change
what it
you're
does.
Talking about.
What's that now?
It's a huge change in taxation policy you're talking about.
Well, you're right. This is not a tap of the hammer. This isn't a twist of the screwdriver and a piece of duct tape. This is a complete overhaul. And frankly, that's what we're going to have. We now have 35,000 lobbyists that are going to work in Washington, D.C. this very day to work over 535 members of Congress. That's 70 lobbyists per each congressman. And their primary job there is to pick winners and losers, to give some people tax breaks. And if I give you a tax break and give you an exemption, somebody's got to make up the difference. So then that person hires a lobbyist to get them off the hook. And guess who ends up taking it in the teeth? The average American. So what this does, it changes the whole basic way of taxation, but it ends the underground economy. If a person is an illegal, they pay. If they're a drug dealer, they pay. If they're a prostitute or a gambler, they pay. So there is no such thing as an underground economy under the fair tax.
Mike Huckabee, we want to get to know you a little better and where you're coming from. You just mentioned, you know, where you grew up. And, of course, oddly, that happens to be Hope, where Bill Clinton famously, you know, planted his flag when he ran for president. You've also said, you said, I'm a conservative, but I'm not mad at anybody about it. So, first of all, why does Hope produce so many presidential candidates? And secondly, what kind of conservative are you? What do you mean you're not mad at anybody about it? We've come to associate a lot of conservatism with a lot of anger. Maybe that's just talk radio, but I don't think so.
Well, I think that there are people on both extremes that just are so vitriolic. But what I say is that I am a conservative, but I'm not angry at anybody. And here's what I mean by that, Tom. I don't think Republicans are right all the time, and I don't think Democrats are wrong all the time. I think one of the biggest problems we have in this country, and I approach it from the standpoint of a governor, and as a governor, I didn't have the luxury of being an ideologue. I'm conservative, but it doesn't mean that all issues we face are horizontal. In fact, I think the biggest problem in politics today is that some people want to take everything and make it a horizontal issue.
What do you mean horizontal? Right, oh, left, right.
Left, right, conservative, Republican, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican. I'm convinced that when the average American family sits at dinner at night, they are not having horizontal conversations. They're talking about issues from a vertical perspective. They want to know, what are you going to do to improve schools? What are you going to do to improve highways? How are you going to improve so I don't sit on an airplane for 6 hours on a tarmac cooking and losing time and sitting there with no water? What are you going to do about whether it's the war in Iraq, our independence of energy? How are you going to deal with the issues of our tax system, the economy? How can you keep it so that I don't get the pink slip after working for 25 years for the same company and watch this job disappear to China? Those are issues that people care about. Frankly, I don't think they care whether a Democrat or a Republican fixes it. But what they don't want is the kind of mess we had at Katrina that was an embarrassment to this nation. And it's not a matter of pointing fingers. It's a matter of getting our hands dirty and fixing some problems.
So it sounds, though, that behind your words there, Mike Huckabee, you are pointing fingers at the way the Republican Party has kind of run its business recently, the polarization that we've got in this country. I mean, I must say, I've certainly sat at family dinners where some of these real hot-button horizontal issues, you call them, are right on the table. I mean, in necks of the woods that come around to you, where people don't want fundamentalist Christian relatives who do not want evolution discussed at the table, don't want to hear the word said. I mean, that's not, you know, that's not pink slips. That's right down at the values worldview level.
Well, I just, maybe I'm having different dinners, but, you know, I don't hear a whole lot of people talking about evolution. And I was shocked that that came up in the debates. You know, it was interesting. We had three Republican debates, and guess how many questions we had on education? Not one. Not one question on education. Are you telling me that education is not an important issue? It is to me.
But a lot of people see evolution as part of the education question. What is the kind of education that we're going to give to our children? Can we really value science if we look away from the scientific process?
I don't know of anybody running for president who suggests that we look away from science. What if people would listen to my message that I delivered at the National Education Association just last week in Philadelphia, they would hear me talking about that we need to make sure that we're not leaving children behind, which we are by cutting music and art programs out of our schools. Tom, I'm the only person I know that's saying that we've got a future that's built on a creative economy. And one of the dumbest things we've done in education in the last generation is we have cut music and art programs out of our schools, and they ought to be an integral part of the curriculum, because if we don't develop both left and right sides of a child's brain, if all we do is just download data and we don't help those students to have a real processor that operates to know what to do with that data, which music and art helps their creative juices flow, gives them a chance to think about not just what, but why and how. If we really aren't doing that, then there's a reason, and that's part of why 6,000 kids a day drop out of school in this country. 6,000.
Does that mean you would step away from No Child Left Behind, and it's teach to the test is everything sort of focus? Is that another?
No, and that's a mistaken notion about No Child Left Behind. In fact, one of the positive things, No Child Left Behind, for the first time in our country's history, actually said that music and art should be a part of the core curriculum. The problem is there's not an objective way to evaluate or measure.
Yeah.
So what a lot of school districts did, rather than follow the process of NCLB with music and art programs, since they weren't going to be evaluated on it, they just cut those programs and said the only thing we're going to deal with is what we're evaluated on. Now, there's been some problems, and some districts have taught to the test, so to speak, but I think that's a really more of a failure of application at the local level. That's not what No Child Left Behind does. One positive thing, it treats every student as an individual with intrinsic worth. It doesn't allow you to take a kid who is English as second language, or maybe who's a disabled child or a minority child, and aggregate him into the total mix of the school and lose him by saying the school's great, even though we have kids who are miserably failing and we're doing nothing to help. That's a good thing. Now, the bad thing, its strength is also its weakness. If you take a relatively good school, but then you skew the results because you have a disproportionate number of either achievement gap kids or ESL kids or IDEA kids, then you've got the same kind of problem. So does it need tweaking? Yes. But it's not completely a disaster. In fact, it's proven to be very helpful in many states. Our state, for example, in Arkansas, has seen dramatic improvement in our overall academic achievement, graduation rate, what we've done with the curriculum. We're considered one of the top states in terms of turning around our performance and closing the achievement gap.
Governor, let us turn to our listeners and callers, if we could. Mike Huckabee's with us. He's running for the GOP nomination for the presidency. Chris is calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Chris. You're on the air with Mike Huckabee.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am involved with a group that's called Iowans for Sensible Priorities. As you know, I think Mr. Huckabee is aware of us, but we are advocating reduction of spending on these obsolete weapon systems that were designed to fight the Cold War, or which has long since been over, but we're still spending about $60 billion a year on those stuff. And you've talked about needs in education and such, and we advocate that we shift that money towards social programs. I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on this issue and whether you'd be willing to support us, because we have the support of already close to 10,000 Iowa caucus attenders, both Republicans and Democrats.
That gets a candidate's attention. Iowans for Essential Priorities. Mike Huckabee, what do you say?
Well, I think Chris is on the right track when he says that we need to reevaluate what we're spending federal money on. And if it's obsolete weapon systems, or if it's obsolete desk and chairs or toilet seats at the Pentagon, we need to be reevaluating it. And one way to do that is to have a completely transparent federal expenditure system where every expenditure is on the internet and any citizen could track it, could look at it, and find out what they paid to mow the lawn at the federal building in Cincinnati.
But what about the thematic shift away from defense and towards social issues and expenditure? What do you think?
If we're talking about getting rid of obsolete systems, yes. If we're talking about cutting and then not having enough money to take care of veterans, not having enough money to properly equip the current Army, then no, we can't make that shift. But I don't think that's what Chris is talking about. And I think if any American would not object to making sure that we weren't spending money on weapon systems that really were no longer applicable for the kind of world in which we live.
Chris, thanks for your call. Let's go to Alice in Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air with Mike Huckabee.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. Mm-hmm. First of all, I agree with Mr. Huckabee about the Iraq situation. In fact, I seem to be turning from an independent to a conservative after listening to him, except for a couple of points. But another thing I'd like to say is I don't think we as citizens have been asked to do anything to help make the people of Iraq feel our concern and our willingness to help.
We've sacrificed 3,500 plus soldiers, but you're saying more directly in our lives as civilians.
My personal self, about maybe stop driving. Is there nothing I can do as an individual to help with this?
Mike Huckabee, Alice wants to know why Americans haven't been asked to pitch in more broadly.
Let's go all the way back to September 11th. If there was one overwhelming maybe mistake that was made early on in responding to the attack on the United States, we were told essentially, go back to living your lives, get back to the theater, go back to ball games, let's go back shopping, and let's travel again. Now, I understand what we were really saying was, let's not let these guys wreck our economy. Let's, put it up their nose, and the best way to do that is to get back to our lives. But, you know, the unfortunate part, we did go back to living just like we did before, which meant we went right back to the harsh partisanship, right back to the same name-calling. And as a result, our country is now more polarized and divided than it's ever been. In every other war we've ever fought, there's always been a common sense of sacrifice that we all had to put something in, that we all had something to offer. And what Alice is saying, I agree with. I think one of the ways we ought to call this country together is let's decide that within a decade we're going to be completely free of foreign oil. Now, I know that's a bold statement. I have people laugh at me for saying that. That's all right. They laughed at President Kennedy when he said we were going to put a man on the moon within a decade when we were dealing with the essential technology of bottle rockets.
Why hasn't your party already made that its goal? I mean, you've got
because
a Republican in the White House. What are we waiting for?
Because our party is tied to oil. I can tell you why. You want to know the honest truth?
Yes.
Because we're tied to oil. And we are allowing ourselves to be completely sucked into both an oil economy. We're tied to it that way. We're also tied into the governments in the Middle East. And it's time we say, you know, we can't live the rest of our children's futures based on every time we squeeze the pump, making the Saudi royal family even more obscenely rich.
How are you going to break that tie, Governor? How are you going to do it as a GOP candidate? Is that why you don't have more contributions? Because those interests aren't coffering into you?
Well, I guarantee you they're probably not looking at me as their favorite. I mean, I'm not going to be the boy of Wall Street because I think that it's time the Republican Party start realizing that if the only people we care about are the people on Wall Street and the lobbyists on K Street, we're going to lose the people on Main Street. And that's what we've done. We've lost those folks, and we're not going to get them back if people don't believe we're going to be fighting so that they can keep their jobs. And that's not happening when we have a trade situation that's supposed to be free, but it's not free if it's not fair, and it's not fair because we're operating under guidelines that we're not insisting that other nations operate with. We have a situation of corporate corruption where we have CEOs that will take a $100 million bonus from a company and ask for huge sacrifices on the parts of the ordinary worker, the baggage handlers, the ticket agents.
Governor Huckabee, let's go to Pete in Boston. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to first say it's a great honor to talk to Governor Huckabee. I'm an independent, and I'm looking at all the different options, but I've really been drawn to Governor Huckabee because he seems like the most sincere person with a brain in his head. I mean, there's definitely people who are very passionate on both sides, but very sincere and really has convictions, you know, really stands for things. I think sometimes he gets pigeonholed given all the Christian questions and the moral questions. He's not allowed to expand more on some of the most important issues. So I want to ask...
He is a Baptist minister, but you're looking right on to the bigger picture as well. And what's your question,
Pete? For me, as a Christian, I want to applaud Governor Huckabee for not shying away. A lot of these guys are you know, shucking and jiving and trying to answer it down the middle.
But on what?
On abortion. On
he's against
marriage.
It, straight up. He's against that, straight up.
But he says it. He says it in a way. It's not like he says he's not angry at anybody. He's not coming at it where we have to you know, demonize people. And I think that's important. But what I wanted to ask a question about was the healthcare situation.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading more about his stuff because I really haven't been able to hear much about his stuff because he's never asked these questions at the debates. I wanted to ask because he's so into like overhauling different departments regarding why he's against a single payer system.
Why is he against a universal single payer system, sort of expanding the Medicaid?
Not exactly what the Democrats are looking for, but something that it seems like a lot of his stuff is like he's not really. I'd like to hear about the insurance companies, what he thinks should be done about that kind of stuff.
Pete, let us do it. Mike Huckabee, there's a great big hairy one. American healthcare, and you want everybody covered, but you're not for single payer, and Pete wants to know why.
Well, let's say I would be for a single payer if the single payer is each individual who's empowered to make his or her own medical decisions. But I'd sure hate to turn my medical decisions and my health over to the same people who run the air traffic control system.
A lot of people feel that way about the HMOs that run their health care now.
And I don't think the HMOs are the answer. The answer is empower me as an individual. Give me the opportunity to know not only what each procedure cost, let me know what quality of health care is available to me, which doctors, which hospitals, which clinics have the best reputation and the best records for actually healing people of the things that that I have. Let me know what my options are. Empower me to do it. But Tom, there's a bigger issue. We don't have a health care crisis in the country. We've got the best health care system. That's why when people are sick anywhere else in the world,
40 million people not covered yet.
No, you're talking about coverage.
That's a system, isn't it?
Health care is not our crisis. Mm-hmm. Health is our crisis. 80% of our health care costs are driven by chronic disease. Chronic disease is what's really just completely bankrupting the economic future of the country. And chronic disease is largely caused by three behaviors: overeating, under-exercising, and smoking. And when nearly 80% of all healthcare costs are related to chronic disease, and what we really have is not a lack of good medical care, we have a few people accessing a whole bunch of it, and a whole lot of people not able to access any of it.
When you were 300 pounds, you were part of that danger zone, they found diabetes danger there, and you lost a whole bunch. But what are you saying? Don't worry about the overhauling the system or getting single payer. Just go home and diet, lose weight?
No. No, we can't ignore that 47 million people are uninsured. But some of them are uninsured. They choose not to be because they're healthy. Some are uninsured because they're poor. So we need to make sure we understand that some of this lack of coverage is that people just decide not to. But the bigger issue is changing the culture of the country. Mm. And this is where we're not hearing it. We're hearing all about coverage and coverage. But let me tell you, we're spending almost 17% of our gross domestic product on health care in this country. There's no other nation on earth that spends more than 10.5%. Switzerland spends that. Most European nations, 9.5%.
So are you going to cut back on the agricultural subsidies that go to corn and make Twinkies?
Hold on. If we could get our gross domestic product down to 11% of health care, more than anybody else, that's $700 billion a year savings. If we did electronic medical records, we'd end a lot of errors. We'd be able to put billions of dollars back into coverage. There's actually, if you took all of the uncompensated care and the extra cost that it causes us, there's probably enough money in the system that you could provide a basic coverage policy, just like we did for children in Arkansas when I first became governor, because we realized that it cost less money to prevent a disease than it does to treat a disease. Now, here's where we're making the mistake in America. Mm. We are all fixated on what are we going to do to cover people when they get desperately ill, and what we're missing is why don't we start taking the steps to keep them from getting so desperately ill. We're a nation that's treating snake bites when we need to be killing snakes. We're building ambulances for people falling off the cliff when we need to put a fence at the top of the cliff so they don't fall off.
Get people to take care of their own health, you're saying.
It's a major thing, and I'll tell you why politicians don't want to touch it, because we like to take on topics we can resolve in an election cycle, and this can't be. This is going to take a generational cycle. In my lifetime, I've seen four major cultural shifts that I can think of: litter, seatbelt use, smoking, drunk driving. We've had radical changes in how we approach those issues from the way that they were looked at when I was a child, and it didn't happen overnight. It took first an attitude change with education and information, then an atmospheric change. We actually started putting no smoking signs up and taking the ashtrays away. Things began to change atmospherically. Ultimately, once behavioral norms started shifting and more people were maybe living healthy than unhealthy and doing the right thing, then we codified the new behavioral norm with passing laws that said we'll have a primary seatbelt law, or we'll pass complete smoking bans. In Arkansas, one of the last acts I signed as a governor was a Clean Indoor Air Act that made every single workplace in the entire state smoke-free.
So shape up America and shape up the workplace and shape up everything. Shape up.
Well, frankly, if we don't, we're not going to be able to afford whatever coverage we have because that 17% of gross domestic product at the current rate goes to 20% by the year 2015. Yeah. There's a reason GM today has more money in health care benefits in each car that it builds than it does in the steel that goes into making the car. Starbucks Coffee spends more money on health care benefits, and they're a marvelous company in that they provide health care benefits for their employees, albeit a pretty much younger set of employees. It's an admirable thing they're doing. But here's the issue for them. It's now costing more to cover their employees than it is to purchase coffee for the entire Starbucks chain. Companies can't keep up with that.
That is amazing. Governor Huckabee, speak to this. We've got a lot of listeners in big primary states, Iowa, South Carolina. Conservatives, perhaps, who are looking at you and the three who've been seen as the front runners, McCain, Giuliani, Romney. Why should conservatives go for you and not these guys who are out front right now? What are your conservative bona fides here?
Well, I didn't just recently come to the convictions that I hold.
What convictions?
Well, the convictions that life begins at conception. Of course, that includes the idea that it doesn't end at birth. I think I'm a pro-life person that people who aren't even maybe pro-life can understand that I come from it from the perspective that it's not just about saying we're going to protect the life of a child while it's in the womb, but we're also going to be concerned about that child once he's out beyond the womb. We don't want him sleeping under a bridge or in the back of a car having the daylights whacked out of him by some abusive parent.
But you're the real anti-abortion voice, you're saying. What else?
You know, I wouldn't want to say anti-abortion. I'm pro-life. There's a real distinction.
Wouldn't you make abortion illegal? Wouldn't you like to see it made illegal nationally?
I'd love to see that go away, not just because the laws did it, but because our conscience has said that we value every human life. You know, I've always said what makes us unique as an American culture is our elevation and celebration of each human life as if it represents the life of the rest of us. And that's what makes us a nation that will go looking for a Boy Scout in the woods of North Carolina. That's what causes us to go launch a full-scale search for a hiker in Mount Hood.
What about gun control, then? You're against it. You pack a pistol sometimes. Your son was arrested with one coming onto a plane earlier this year. What's that about?
The smartest thing he's ever done.
Loaded
no,
Glock.
I believe the Second Amendment is just as precious and valuable as the First Amendment. You know, it's always interesting to me that people want to make the Second Amendment geographical or they want to make it antiquated. I don't ever hear anybody suggesting we do that with the First Amendment.
Gay rights, gay marriage.
We're having enough trouble in this country trying to make heterosexual marriage work, and I'm just not sure we're ready to take on a new experiment. Marriage needs to mean something. It has always historically meant a relationship between a male and a female. It's never meant anything other than that. If people want to live a different way, I think that's their personal business. I'm not going to interfere with that. But if they want to redefine the definition of marriage or family, then that calls up for some discussion and debate, and I think we have a right to say, no, we're not going to change the historic definitions of family.
Creationism to be taught in American public schools alongside evolution. Why?
Well, I'm not sure that it ought to be taught alongside, if you mean on equal basis. I frankly think that's an issue that states ought to deal with and local school boards. My own feeling is this. It doesn't bother me at all that my kids who are in public schools their entire lives, first through 12th grade, and by the way, Tom, I was the first governor in 50 years in my state whose kids actually went to public schools in my state.
That's a long
time. For their entire school life.
Wow.
I always find it interesting. These people get up and talk about their love for public schools. They love it for the rest of us. They don't love it for their own kids. And I really have a problem with politicians who pander to the public school issue, but it's not good enough for their own kids. But my kids were exposed to every kind of teaching. It didn't bother me. I don't expect the schools to religiously indoctrinate my kids. That's why that I felt that was my responsibility as a parent. I just don't want – there is a view of creation. Now, I think when one gets all worked up about the issues, here's the point. Do we have a world that was the result of a God who was behind it, or the result of just a biological accident that sort of then randomly mutated? And by the way, if that is in fact what we're dealing with, then why are we worried about global warming? If the world is in an evolutionary process and it simply is adapting, well, then it could be argued that global warming is the natural adaptation of a changing world, and we ought to just sit back and accept
but
it.
But it's when we have control of it. I mean, isn't that where it comes right down to how you see human beings and their responsibility? I mean, we're part of this process. This is our smokestack belching
fog. I would take a different tact and say that because I do have faith and because I do believe that the world doesn't belong to me, it belongs to God, and I'm just getting a chance to enjoy it and use it, I can't abuse it. I don't have the right to do that because it's not mine. I ought to practice the old Boy Scout rule, leave it in better shape than I found it. So my stewardship of the earth, my point of being a conservationist, which I am, and I think Republicans have not been as much on the leadership as they need to be on the environment. But it's not because I'm going around blaming human beings for enjoying the earth. No, I want to do it because it's the right thing to do to make sure that the future generations have a world that is as clean, if not cleaner, that is as green, if not greener, that is as wholesome, that is productive. Mm. That it ought to be because I value this world as a gift from God, and therefore, because it's not mine, I've got a significant responsibility to take good care of it and manage it properly.
Governor Huckabee, let me ask you, you've got a tone that suggests compassionate conservatism. George W. Bush had that message when he ran for the White House. We've watched what has happened. Is that a problem for you? Has George Bush given compassionate conservatism a bad name?
Well, I don't use the term compassionate conservative. I think that if a person is truly a conservative, he will exercise and exhibit compassion. But part of the reason I have compassion for people is twofold. Number one, I didn't come up a child of privilege. I was the first male in my entire family lineage to even graduate high school. I know what it's like to break the cycle of poverty. I've lived it. I thank God every day I live in a country where my parents could make sacrifices and wish and dream and hope for me to do better than they did. And I did it because I had great public schools where teachers inspired me, because I lived in a community where people wanted me to do well and didn't hold me back, even though I didn't grow up on the right side of town. I realize what a blessed gift it is to be an American. I love this country. And I think every kid ought to grow up believing that there's an unlimited possibility. I've gotten in trouble with Republicans because I've defended Bill Clinton, not on his personal life or his politics, but I've said, guys, don't ever let it be lost on you that here is a guy who came out of a small, obscure southern state, came from a broken home, had a tough life growing up, but he aspired to be president of the United States, and he got there not once but twice. So no matter what you think of his politics, no matter how disappointed you are in his personal life, don't ever let it be lost on you that he, in essence, affirmed that America was still a place where an ordinary kid could go to the top. Mm. And if we ever lose that, we've lost more than the next election. We've lost the soul of this country. This country is based on the idea that you don't really get to choose where you start, but you have a heck of a lot to do with where you end up.
Mike Huckabee, we just got a minute left here. Polls almost all suggest that your party, the GOP, is kind of behind the eight ball right now. It has not been a good time for the sitting president or for the party, and we've seen evidence of that in the polls last fall. In a nutshell, what's the problem? Where has the Republican Party gone wrong?
Republican Party spent like Democrats, so they didn't carry out a fiscal responsibility. They ignored corruption in their own midst. When it broke loose, they didn't do enough. and they weren't vocal enough about the manner in which it was handled. I think people are still understandably angry about the complete disastrous handling of what happened in the Gulf Coast and Hurricane Katrina. There's unrest about the war. Republicans have, in many ways, done it to themselves, and they didn't stand for the things that supposedly we're supposed to stand for. Now, I don't think that means the party's done or we're finished, because, frankly, the Democrats haven't done a very good job of standing for anything either. And if anything, the American people are even more disdainful of the current Congress by the numbers. 14% approval rating. President Bush is at least in the 20s. But the point is, people are just disgusted, period. And you know what, Tom? I don't blame them. I'm disgusted, too. That's one of the reasons I'm running.
Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, in there swinging, and we hear it. Governor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Tom, it was a real pleasure. Thank you and your listeners.
Great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.